Welcome to today's deep dive. We have got a truly wild one for you today.
We really do. It's highly concerning, but also just fascinating.
Exactly. So we are pulling all our information today from two incredibly detailed, deeply researched articles from the OOTW Journal.
Right.
The first one is called Amanita muscaria, the neuroscience, and the second is this really brilliant comparative analysis titled Amanita versus psilocybin, Opposite Brains.
Which is such a great title, honestly, because it perfectly captures what we're looking at.
It really does, because our mission for you today is very specific. We are going to completely dismantle the modern multi-billion dollar, quote unquote, legal magic mushroom market.
Yeah, dismantle is the right word here.
Right. And we are doing this by unpacking the astonishingly misunderstood neuroscience of the world's most recognizable mushroom. I'm talking about the red and white Amanita muscaria, which is also known as the fly agaric.
Right. The classic fairy tale mushroom.
Exactly. I mean, you've seen this mushroom your entire life. It's in fairy tales. It's literally the mushroom emoji on your phone, you
Yeah.
know?
Yeah, it's you grab it for a power up in classic video games. It's everywhere in our culture.
It is everywhere. But the science we are about to get into today is wildly darker and far more complex than the fiction.
The urgency of this topic, honestly, it really can't be overstated
Yeah.
because we are currently sitting in the middle of this legal psychedelic gold rush.
A massive one.
Yeah, you can walk into almost any corner store or a gas station or high-end wellness boutique, and you will see these mushroom gummy products sold openly on the shelves.
Right there next to the candy.
Exactly. But as the medical and chemical literature reveals, the neuropharmacology of the legal mushroom, this Amanita muscaria, and the illegal mushroom, psilocybin, run in exact opposite
The
directions.
complete opposite.
Complete. The marketplace treats them as chemical cousins. But your brain, however, treats them as completely alien to one another.
Wow.
Yeah. And one of these carries a genuine brain-destroying toxin,
Right.
while the other currently holds FDA breakthrough therapy status for treating severe depression.
That contrast is just, it's staggering.
It is. We are looking at a scenario where a rapidly expanding marketplace has completely ignored fundamental neuropharmacology. And in the process, they've created a massive, completely unregulated public health hazard.
So to really understand how we got here, I want you to picture this scenario. You walk into a modern wellness shop, or even just a gas station nowadays.
Right.
There's a very specific visual language you expect, right? You wander over to the supplement aisle and you see bright colors, maybe a groovy, wavy, psychedelic font.
Yeah, the classic 1960s aesthetic.
Exactly. And there's a little cartoon mushroom winking at you from a shiny Mylar bag.
Right. And that aesthetic is very deliberately engineered to project a sense of harmless natural expansion.
Right.
The packaging is essentially making a promise to the consumer. It promises a gentle, predictable, perhaps slightly mystical journey.
And your brain, seeing that visual shorthand, instantly puts the product into a neat little mental box. You look at it and think, oh, okay, this is just a milder, legal version of those magic mushrooms everyone is always talking about in the news.
Yep, it feels incredibly safe.
Totally safe. It's sitting right there next to the CBD sleep gummies, the organic energy drinks, the vitamin C packets.
No.
It's retail. It has a barcode, so you think, well, it must be fine. But this is exactly what the OOTW Journal articles call the Great Gummy Deception.
The great gummy deception. I love that term because it's a profound deception based on a categorical blurring.
Categorical blurring. Break that down for us.
So the implicit logic of the marketplace is that because both of these organisms belong to the same biological kingdom, meaning they're both fungi, they must have similar pharmacological profiles.
Which makes sense on a superficial level, I guess.
Superficial, yes. But biologically, that assumption is absurd. The kingdom of fungi is vast. It's ancient. Assuming that two mushrooms have the same effect on the human central nervous system just because they're both mushrooms
Right.
is like assuming a great white shark and a golden retriever have the same temperament just because they're both animals.
Oh, wow. That is a great way to put it.
Or, assuming that because a potato and deadly nightshade are both in the Solanaceae plant family, they both make for a good French fry.
I love that comparison because it really highlights just the utter absurdity of it. But the companies selling these gummies, they're leaning into that absurdity for profit.
Absolutely there.
They group Amanita muscaria and psilocybin together purely based on cultural association. You have this branding dripping in tie-dye backgrounds, marketing copy promising you, quote, expanded consciousness or microdosing clarity.
Right. But the physiological reality of what happens when someone actually ingests an Amanita gummy is completely decoupled from that branding.
So what actually happens? Because the mismatch has to be huge.
It is huge. The mismatch between expectation and pharmacological reality is actually a major source of the adverse events we're seeing in emergency rooms right now.
Wait, really? Like, just the mismatch itself causes problems?
Yes. So in psychedelic literature, there is this fundamental concept known as set and setting.
Right, I've heard of that.
The set is your mindset, your expectations, your mood, what you anticipate is going to happen.
Okay.
If you buy a product marketed with psychedelic fonts and language, your set is primed for a classic serotonergic experience.
You expect to see colors, right?
Right. You expect a lucid, visually expansive, emotionally connected, and highly awake state.
Because that's what psilocybin does. That's the classic magic mushroom trip that people talk about.
Correct. But Amanita muscaria does not provide that.
Yeah.
At all.
Not even a little bit.
No. If you are expecting lucidity and expansion, and instead you are suddenly hit with a heavy, sedating, confusing, and potentially delirious state, where you lose coordination and feel overwhelmingly lethargic, your brain registers that acute mismatch as a medical crisis.
I mean, I would panic too.
Exactly. The panic arises because you feel like your body is shutting down, or you are losing control of your faculties in a way you are totally unprepared for. You haven't just taken a different flavor of a trip. You have introduced fundamentally the wrong drug for your expectation.
Okay, let me try to put this into an everyday context. This is like buying what you think is a highly caffeinated artisanal espresso because the sign above the counter says energy boost and mental clarity.
Right.
But the barista secretly hands you a heavy dose of prescription sleeping pills mixed with over-the-counter cough medicine.
Yes.
Just because both drinks happen to be served with identical white paper coffee cups.
That is perfectly stated.
So you sit down at your laptop waiting to feel hyper-focused and energized, and 20 minutes later, you can't keep your eyes open, your limbs feel like lead, and the room starts spinning.
The physiological panic in that scenario would be intense, and it perfectly maps onto what is happening with these gummies in the real world.
Wow.
And bringing up a sleeping pill is actually the perfect way to look at the actual molecular mechanics at play here.
Oh, okay. Let's get into the mechanics then.
To dismantle this deception, we have to move past the Mylar bags and the marketing myths and look straight into the cellular receptors in the human brain. We're talking about two entirely different pharmacological doors.
Okay, yes. Let's get into the deep neuroscience here. I really want to break down these active compounds, starting with our red and white mushroom, Amanita muscaria.
Sure.
If the active compound isn't psilocybin, what exactly is doing the work here? What is the chemical?
The primary psychoactive compound in a properly prepared Amanita muscaria is a molecule called muscimol.
Muscimol. Okay.
Right. Now, to understand what muscimol does, you first have to understand the brain's natural braking system.
Like the brakes on a car.
Exactly. The human brain operates on a delicate balance of excitation and inhibition. The principal inhibitory neurotransmitter, so the chemical signal that tells neurons to stop firing, to rest, to quiet down, is called GABA.
GABA, gamma-aminobutyric acid, right?
Wow, yes, gamma-aminobutyric acid.
I did some reading before we started. So GABA is the brake pedal for the central nervous system.
It is the brake pedal. When GABA binds to a neuron, it opens a channel that lets negatively charged chloride ions flow into the cell.
Okay, chloride ions. Negatively charged.
Yes, and this lowers the electrical charge of the neuron, which makes it much, much harder for that neuron to fire off a signal.
It quiets things down.
Exactly. Now, muscimol is what medicinal chemists call a structural analog of GABA.
Structural analog, meaning it looks like it.
It mimics the physical shape of the GABA molecule so perfectly that it can bind directly to the brain's GABA receptors. But it doesn't just mimic GABA. It acts as a direct or orthosteric agonist.
Hold on, orthosteric, you're losing me a little bit there. Does that just mean it binds to the receptor, or is it doing something entirely different than what a normal sedative drug like alcohol or a prescription benzo would do? Because I know those affect GABA too, right?
They do, and that's a great point. It is doing something fundamentally different in terms of mechanism.
Yeah.
And this is a critical distinction the OOTW Journal articles make.
Okay, break it down for me.
Drugs like benzodiazepines, think Valium, Xanax, or Klonopin and alcohol, are what we call positive allosteric modulators.
Positive allosteric modulators.
Right. The word allosteric means they bind to a different secondary site on the receptor. They bind to a side door.
So they aren't using the main entrance where GABA normally goes.
No, they are not.
Yeah.
And because they are at the side door, they cannot open the receptor's chloride channel on their own.
Oh, interesting.
They rely entirely on the brain's naturally circulating GABA. When your brain naturally releases a little bit of GABA, the benzodiazepine sitting at the side door essentially acts as an amplifier.
So it just boosts what's already there.
Exactly. It makes the channel stay open longer, or open more frequently, in response to the natural GABA.
Okay, I'm with you.
But, and this is the absolute key here, if there is no natural GABA present, the benzodiazepine does nothing.
Wait, really? It needs the natural GABA to function at all?
It needs the brain's own chemistry to work, which provides a natural biological ceiling to its effect. Your brain is still ultimately in the driver's seat.
Okay, I think I see where this is going. If benzos need the brain's natural GABA to work, what does muscimol do? Does it use the side door too?
No. Muscimol does not need any help. As an orthosteric agonist, muscimol walks right up to the main door of the receptor, the exact site where GABA usually binds, inserts its key, and forces the channel open entirely by itself.
Whoa. So it bypasses the system entirely.
It completely bypasses the brain's natural regulatory system. It doesn't matter what your natural GABA tone is doing at that moment. Muscimol forces those negatively charged chloride ions to flood into the neuron.
Just flooding it.
Flooding it. This hyperpolarizes the neuron, dropping the electrical charge so drastically that the neuron simply cannot fire.
It's just shut off.
Yes. Muscimol doesn't just modulate the brakes. It steps on the brakes with its own foot, and it presses them all the way to the floor.
So if I'm visualizing this, let's say if the brain is a really crowded, noisy, chaotic nightclub.
Right. At this.
Taking benzos or alcohol is like giving the bouncer a megaphone to try and calm the crowd down.
Right.
The bouncer, which is the brain's natural GABA, is still doing the actual work, just with some heavy assistance from the megaphone. But muscimol isn't giving anyone a megaphone. Muscimol is like a rogue bouncer, kicking the front doors open themselves, marching directly to the DJ booth, and violently pulling the plug on the sound system entirely. The music just stops.
The music stops, the lights go dim, and the crowd stops moving. That is a brilliant analogy.
It's terrifying.
It is. And the pharmacology gets even more specific, which explains the very strange subjective effects of this mushroom. Because muscimol isn't just hitting any random GABA receptor in the brain equally.
Okay, what is it targeting?
It has an exceptionally high affinity for a very specific subtype, the extrasynaptic delta subunit receptors.
Extrasynaptic, just breaking down the word, meaning it's located outside the synapse.
Exactly right. Let's visualize the synapse for a second. It is the tiny microscopic gap between two neurons where they communicate.
Right, the gap.
When you have rapid split-second signaling, like moving your hand away from a hot stove, or instantly recognizing a face that happens inside the synapse, that's called phasic inhibition.
Phasic inhibition, fast and localized.
Quick, precise, highly localized. But these delta subunit receptors that muscimol targets, they sit outside of that gap. They sit along the main body of the neuron.
So what are they doing out there if they aren't part of the rapid-fire communication? Are they just hanging out?
They are responsible for a phenomenon called tonic inhibition.
Tonic.
Tonic inhibition isn't a quick, localized stop signal. It is a persistent, constant background dimming of the brain's overall electrical excitability.
Like a dimmer switch.
Yes, like throwing a heavy systemic blanket over the entire nervous system. It regulates your overall state of arousal.
Wow.
In animal models, neuroscientists have found that if you genetically delete this specific delta subunit, muscimol loses more than half of its high affinity binding sites in the brain.
That's a huge drop.
It is. So muscimol's true home, its primary mechanism of action, is the exact system that governs heavy background sedation, motor impairment, and dissociation.
Which perfectly explains what the actual subjective experience of taking Amanita muscaria feels like.
Yes, exactly.
Because the medical literature describes it unequivocally as a downer. It's heavily sedative, it's dissociative, it's deliriant. And there's this incredibly specific word used in the OTW analysis, one narogenic.
The narogenic, yes.
Meaning it induces a waking dream state. That sounds so weird.
It's very unique. At lower to moderate doses, that immense GABAergic tone produces this heavy weighted relaxation, but it also induces these intense, often bizarre, dreamlike states while the user is still partially awake.
So you're dreaming while you're awake.
Well, essentially, yes.
Mm-hmm.
The brain is so heavily inhibited that it begins to process internal imagery similarly to how it does during REM sleep, but without full loss of consciousness.
But what happens at a high dose? Like if the DJ's plug is completely pulled?
At higher doses, because muscimol is forcing those channels open so aggressively and indiscriminately, the user pushes past relaxation to waking dreams.
Into what?
Into severe confusion, delirium, and a complete loss of motor control, which you call ataxia.
Ataxia.
Yes. They might experience intense muscle twitching. And eventually, this cascade leads to heavy, unarousable, coma-like sedation.
Coma-like sedation. It is the literal polar opposite of psilocybin.
Polar opposite.
So let's look at the other side of this coin. Let's talk about the mushroom that Amanita is trying so hard to impersonate on the shelf.
The classic magic mushroom.
Right. When you ingest a classic magic mushroom, your body metabolizes psilocybin into its active form, psilocin.
Correct.
Now, I take it psilocin doesn't go anywhere near this GABA braking system.
Not at all. Psilocin has virtually zero affinity for GABA receptors.
None.
Instead, it agonizes the 5-HT2A serotonin receptors. And importantly, it targets these serotonin receptors specifically on layer 5 cortical pyramidal neurons.
Layer 5 cortical pyramidal neurons? I mean, that sounds intense. What are those and why does it matter that psilocin targets them?
So the cerebral cortex is the outer layer of your brain. It's responsible for complex thought, perception, and memory. And it's arranged in layers.
Okay, layers, got it.
The layer 5 pyramidal neurons are the massive critical output pathways of the cortex.
Like the main highways.
Exactly like highways. They are sending complex integrated thoughts out to the rest of the brain. When psilocin binds to the 5-HT2A receptors on these specific neurons, it does the exact biological opposite of muscimol.
So it doesn't shut them down.
It does not open chloride channels to shut the cell down.
Okay.
Instead, it causes an intense increase in glutamatergic excitation.
Glutamate, that being the opposite of GABA, right? The gas pedal.
Yes. Glutamate is the brain's primary excitatory neurotransmitter. Psilocin makes these massive cortical neurons fire much more readily. It turns the excitability of the cortex all the way up.
Wow.
But it isn't just turning the volume up. It fundamentally changes the actual nature of the signal. The OOTW analysis heavily references the entropic brain hypothesis.
Yes, I saw that.
It's a very influential neuroscientific framework pioneered by researchers like Robin Carhart-Harris.
I really want to unpack this idea of entropy in the brain, because usually we hear entropy used in physics, right?
Right, thermodynamics.
Yeah, thermodynamics. The idea that systems naturally move toward disorder and chaos over time. How does that apply to human consciousness on psychedelics?
It's a fascinating application of the concept. In a normal, sober waking state, your brain operates with a high degree of strict order, predictability, and efficiency.
Okay.
Neurons fire in highly synchronized, well-rehearsed patterns. And this order is necessary to survive. I mean, you need to know how to tie your shoes, drive a car, and recognize danger without having to relearn it every single second.
Right. You need those shortcuts.
Exactly. But under the influence of psilocybin, that strict, synchronized order breaks down. When these cortical neurons are flooded with excitation, their firing becomes asynchronous and desynchronized.
They stop marching in lockstep.
They absolutely do. The brain enters a state of higher entropy. Now, in neuroscience, higher entropy means a higher state of disorder, yes, but it also means a much larger repertoire of potential brain states.
Meaning more possibilities.
Yes. The system becomes highly flexible. You see massive amounts of crosstalk between brain regions that do not normally communicate with one another.
Yeah.
The rigid, well-worn grooves of thought are temporarily flattened out.
And this is where we get into the disintegration of the default mode network, or the DMN. We have to talk about the DMN because it is the absolute core of the psilocybin experience.
It really is.
If I understand it correctly, the DMN is essentially the biological seat of the narrative self, right? It's the part of your brain that maintains your ego, your autobiography, your anxieties.
That is a highly accurate way to frame it. The DMN is a network of interacting brain regions that is highly active when you are awake, but not focused on the outside world.
So like when my mind wanders?
Yes. It is the network responsible for daydreaming, self-reflection, projecting yourself into the future, and ruminating on the past.
So if I'm sitting in traffic, stressing out about an email I have to write tomorrow, or getting mad all over again about a conversation I had 3 weeks ago,
yep.
That's my default mode network, burning calories.
Precisely. The DMN is like the brain's internal taskmaster and archivist. It keeps everything organized, rigidly structured, and entirely egocentric. It filters reality through the lens of, how does this affect me?
Right.
Now, when you introduce psilocybin, this 5-HT2A excitation and the resulting wave of high entropy severely disrupts the DMN.
It breaks it down.
Yes. Functional MRI scans literally show the connectivity of the default mode network breaking apart. it physically disintegrates for the duration of the drug's effect.
The taskmaster leaves the building.
The taskmaster leaves.
Yeah.
And this disintegration is the neural correlate of what people culturally call ego dissolution or ego death.
Wow.
Without the DMN strictly enforcing your autobiography and your rigid beliefs, the brain's priors relax. This allows for profound, expansive, emotionally cathartic insights because you are no longer filtering the world solely through your own conditioned anxieties.
So if we contrast the subjective experience of psilocybin against the waking dream sedation of Amanita,
night and day.
Psilocybin is classic psychedelic, lucid, visionary, insightful, expansive. Even when a psilocybin experience is incredibly intense or challenging, there is a sharp lucidity to it. You aren't falling asleep.
Right. Your pupils dilate. Your heart rate might go up a bit. You are intensely, acutely aware of a high entropy reality.
So if we summarize the two pharmacological paths for you, the listener.
Right. Musimol via GABA brings the brain into a low energy, highly inhibited, sedated, confused dream state.
And psilocin?
Psilocin via 5-HT2A brings the brain into a high energy, highly excited, hyperconnected, lucid, visionary state.
I too.
They are entirely opposite doors leading to entirely opposite brains.
Okay, this is fascinating, but it brings up a huge glaring question for me.
What's that?
If Musimol is essentially just a really potent chemical that turns the brain's volume down, if it just induces this heavy sleep and dissociation through the GABA system, why is Amanita muscaria universally considered toxic? Why does it carry this historical reputation for acute danger? And that brings us to the most terrifying part of our sources today. The dark passenger.
It's a second molecule.
The sec molecule hiding inside the fresh mushroom.
This is the most critical safety information we are covering today. It is the core reason the modern gummy market is so perilous. A fresh Amanita muscaria mushroom does not just contain Musimol.
Okay.
In fact, when it is fresh or raw, it contains a significantly higher concentration of a completely different chemical.
Which is?
Ibotenic acid.
Ibotenic acid. The OOTW papers refer to it as a decarboxylation prodrug.
Right.
I need you to break that chemistry down for me because that sounds like a mouthful. What exactly is a prodrug and what is decarboxylation?
Let's start with a prodrug. A prodrug is a biologically inactive or differently active chemical compound that your body or some external chemical process metabolizes into the primary active drug.
So it's a precursor.
It is a precursor. Now look at the molecular structure of ibotenic acid. It is very similar to Musimol, but it has an extra piece attached to it, a carboxyl group.
A carboxyl group.
Which is just a specific arrangement of carbon and oxygen atoms.
Okay, so ibotenic acid is basically Musimol wearing a heavy chemical backpack.
A very good visualization.
Yeah.
Now, when you expose ibotenic acid to heat, or when the mushroom dries out in the sun, or even when it passes through the highly acidic environment of your digestive tract, a chemical reaction occurs.
What happens to the backpack?
That carboxyl group, the backpack, is stripped away and released as carbon dioxide. That chemical process of removing the carboxyl group is called decarboxylation.
Ah, okay, decarboxylation.
And when ibotenic acid loses that carboxyl group, its molecular structure is permanently transformed. It literally becomes Musimol.
So the mushroom naturally manufactures this precursor, ibotenic acid, which eventually transforms into the Musimol that causes the heavy sedation. But wait, why is ibotenic acid itself a problem? If it just turns into the other thing anywhere, what is the big deal if I eat it?
The big deal is what ibotenic acid does in the human brain before it has a chance to convert.
Oh!
Because ibotenic acid is not a GABA agonist. It doesn't put the brain to sleep. It is a potent agonist of the NMDA receptor.
And what does that receptor do?
It is a major receptor for glutamate.
Wait, glutamate, the gas pedal you mentioned earlier.
Exactly. While Musimol shuts neurons down, ibotenic acid kicks them into absolute screaming overdrive.
Wow, so they are in the same mushroom but doing opposite things.
Yes, but it pushes them so incredibly hard that it triggers a catastrophic cellular phenomenon known as excitotoxicity.
Excitotoxicity, just looking at the word, it literally excites the neurons until they die.
It excites them to death. And the mechanism of how it kills them is brutal.
How does it happen?
When ibotenic acid binds to the NMDA receptor, it locks the channel open, allowing a massive, unregulated flood of calcium ions to pour into the neuron.
I'm trying to visualize this. Calcium is good for bones, right? Why is a flood of calcium so bad inside a brain cell?
Inside a resting neuron, calcium levels are kept extremely low and tightly regulated. It acts as a signaling molecule, But when a flood of calcium breaches the cell, it creates chaos.
Chaos how?
The mitochondria, the powerhouses of the cell, try to absorb the excess calcium to protect the neuron, but they become so overloaded that they swell up and fail.
The power shuts down.
Right. And without energy, the cell cannot pump the calcium back out. This high calcium concentration then activates a cascade of destructive enzymes inside the cell.
Destructive enzymes?
Yes. These enzymes literally begin digesting the cell's internal structural proteins and its DNA.
That is horrifying. So it's not just turning the cell off, it is structurally demolishing the cell from the inside out.
Exactly. It causes the cell membrane to rupture, spilling its contents and triggering massive local inflammation. And what makes ibotenic acid so specific is that it destroys the cell bodies of the neurons while leaving the passing axons, the long cables connecting other neurons, intact.
And this brings us to an absolutely jaw-dropping fact from the OOTW Journal. A fact that, when I read it, completely shattered any lingering idea I had of this being a harmless wellness gummy.
I know exactly what you're going to say.
Neuroscientists are fully aware of how efficiently ibotenic acid causes this excitotoxic cellular death. They know exactly how it works, so well, in fact, that it is a standard, heavily utilized tool in neurobiology toolkits worldwide.
Yes. In modern neuroscience laboratories, if a researcher needs to study what happens when a highly specific microscopic part of an animal's brain is permanently removed or destroyed, they don't use a scalpel to cut it out.
Because a scalpel is too messy.
Right, that would damage the surrounding tissue and passing axons. Mm. Instead, they use a stereotaxic syringe to inject a microscopic amount of purified ibotenic acid directly into that defined brain region.
They inject it to kill the tissue.
It is a standard excitotoxic brain lesioning reagent. You can buy it from chemical supply catalogs explicitly for the purpose of creating permanent brain damage in animal models, such as rats or macaques, to study the resulting loss of cognitive or motor function.
I just want to pause and let that sink in for you listening right now. The chemical that professional scientists purchase to intentionally, permanently destroy specific targeted regions of animal brains is the exact same chemical that is naturally present inside these colorful, legal mushroom gummies sold next to the beef jerky at the gas station.
It's unbelievable. And the scientific irony is profound because neuroscience also uses muscle in the exact same labs.
Wait, they use both?
Yes.
Yeah.
But they use muscimol for the opposite experimental purpose. Because muscimol is such a potent, reliable GABA agonist, researchers inject muscimol to reversibly silence a brain region.
So they use it to put a specific part of the brain to sleep.
Exactly. It temporarily puts the area to sleep without killing the cells so they can study temporary loss of function. Once the muscimol washes out, the brain region wakes back up.
So this single iconic red and white mushroom contains both the permanent cellular destroyer ibotenic acid and the temporary cellular silencer muscimol. That is staggering.
It really is.
But I want to push back on this a little, or at least address what the internet says, because I've seen people talk about this online.
The folk wisdom.
Right. There's a lot of folk wisdom on Reddit and mushroom forums that says, oh, you just dry the caps out. If you put the Amanita mushrooms in the oven or make a hot tea out of them, the heat decarboxylates all the bad ibotenic acid into the good muscimol, and then the final product is perfectly safe.
Yes, I hear that all the time.
How true is that?
The OTW sources address this directly, relying on hard analytical chemistry. They specifically cite data from ACS laboratories. Now, the foundational chemistry is real. Drying and heating absolutely do cause decarboxylation.
Okay, so the internet isn't totally wrong.
Not totally. That is the basis of the traditional folk practice. But the critical, dangerous reality is that this conversion is always incomplete.
Incomplete, meaning you don't get all of it to convert.
Yes. You cannot achieve 100% conversion in a home kitchen, in an oven, or even in the vast majority of commercial unregulated manufacturing setups that make these gummies. A dried product, a brewed tea, or a manufactured extract still contains residual ibotenic acid.
So the neurotoxin is still there.
The excitotoxin remains in the final product. Every time.
It's like trying to bake the poison out of a cake, right? You put it in the oven and the heat starts destroying the poison on the outside layer. Sure, maybe you cooked off 80% of it.
Right.
But the heat doesn't reach the core evenly. So the center of the cake is still a lethal neurotoxin. Who wants to eat a slice of cake knowing that 20% of it is still a literal brain lesioning agent?
It is an excellent analogy and it highlights the hidden danger perfectly. And this incomplete conversion is precisely why home preparations, and especially these commercially sold gray market gummies, have violently unpredictable potencies and toxicity profiles.
Violently unpredictable.
Yes. The natural baseline levels of muscimol and ibotenic acid vary wildly from mushroom to mushroom. It changes based on the season it was picked, the region of the world it grew in, the specific genetic variant, and exactly how long and at what temperature it was processed.
That is so many variables.
Too many. As a consumer, you have absolutely no idea what ratio of temporary silencer to permanent destroyer you are putting into your body.
So given that modern analytical chemistry knows exactly what these two chemicals are, we know one is an excitotoxin and one is a GABA sedative. How on earth did the medical community historically get so confused about how to treat people who showed up poisoned by this mushroom?
It's a crazy story.
Because the OTW articles point out a massive historical blunder that literally put patients' lives at risk for decades.
This is one of the most fascinating cautionary tales in the history of clinical pharmacology. It all comes down to a nomenclature trap, a naming error that calcified into medical dogma.
Okay, lay it on us.
The mushroom itself, Amanita muscaria, has been famous for centuries. In 1869, two chemists managed to isolate a specific chemical compound from a batch of these mushrooms. Because they extracted it from Amanita muscaria, they creatively named the compound muscarine.
Okay, that makes perfect logical sense for 1869. They found a chemical in the muscaria mushroom, they called it muscarine?
Right. And over the following decades, neurobiologists began mapping out the human nervous system. They discovered a massive fundamental class of receptors that respond to the neurotransmitter acetylcholine.
Okay.
When they tested the chemical muscarine on these receptors, it activated them powerfully. So they named this entire biological system after the mushroom extract, the muscarinic acetylcholine receptors.
And these receptors do what exactly? Are they important?
Extremely. They are a core part of your parasympathetic nervous system, the rest and digest system. They control smooth muscle contraction, heart rate, and glandular secretions. This biological system is foundational. It is taught in the first year of every medical school, veterinary school, and pharmacy program in the world.
So if they named a massive piece of human biology after this chemical, muscarine must be the main active ingredient in the mushroom, right?
That is the blunder. Muscimol and ibotenic acid, the actual chemicals responsible for the heavy sedation, the waking dreams, and the excitotoxicity we've been discussing, were incredibly difficult to isolate.
Oh, really?
They weren't successfully isolated and identified until nearly a century later, in 1964.
100 years later.
By independent research teams in Japan, England, and Switzerland. And when modern chemistry finally analyzed the fresh Amanita muscaria mushroom completely, they realized something almost absurd.
What did they find?
Muscarine, the namesake chemical, only accounts for roughly 0.00003% of the fresh mushroom's weight.
Wait, what? 0.00003%. Yeah. That is a trace amount. That is essentially a rounding error in a spreadsheet.
Exactly.
Yeah.
It is present in such microscopic, insignificant trace amounts that it cannot possibly account for the profound psychotropic effects or the severe toxicity of the mushroom.
That's hilarious, but also terrible.
Right. In contrast, there are other, far more dangerous fungi out there in the woods, like certain inosive and clitosibe species, which contain up to 1.6% muscarine. Those are the mushrooms that cause genuine muscarinic poisoning.
Okay.
But the fly agaric, the mushroom that actually gave the receptor its name, it barely contains a drop of it.
I am having a hard time wrapping my head around this. Science literally named a massive piece of human biology, the muscarinic receptors, after a compound that is essentially just a speck of dust inside this mushroom.
Yeah.
That's like naming the entire Pacific Ocean after a specific single grain of sand on the beach in California. It's completely absurd.
It is absurd, but it created a very real, very dangerous clinical trap for doctors.
How so?
Let's put ourselves in the shoes of an emergency room physician. A patient is wheeled in. They are deeply delirious. They are twitching. They are heavily sedated, maybe oscillating between agitation and near coma.
Mm.
Their friends tell the triage nurse, he ate a fly agaric or he ate Amanita muscaria.
Right.
The doctor, relying on years of rigorous medical training, hears the word muscaria and immediately thinks, oh, muscarinic poisoning.
Because that's what is printed in the medical textbook.
Exactly. And the textbook says that genuine muscarinic poisoning causes a very specific dangerous syndrome, often remembered by medical students using the acronym SLDGE.
SLDGE. What does that stand for?
Salivation, lacrimation, which is excessive tearing from the eyes, urination, defecation, gastrointestinal distress, and emesis or vomiting.
Wow, so everything's just leaking out.
Yes, your parasympathetic nervous system goes into overdrive, and your body essentially uncontrollably purges fluids.
So what's the treatment for that?
The reflexive, life-saving medical treatment for severe SLAGGE syndrome is to administer a powerful antidote called atropine, which blocks those muscarinic receptors.
Okay, wait. But we just established that the patient isn't actually suffering from muscarinic poisoning because there isn't enough muscarine in the mushroom to cause it.
Right.
They are suffering from muscimol and ibotenic acid poisoning.
Precisely the problem. The real toxidrome for Amanita muscaria is driven by heavy GABA-A agonism and NMDA excitotoxicity. It often presents clinically as an anticholinergic or delirium state, dry skin, severe agitation, delirium, confusion, and heavy sedation.
Right. The exact opposite of SLDGE.
Yes. If a doctor misinterprets the poisoning and gives a patient in that state atropine, the atropine can actually exacerbate the delirium, raise the heart rate dangerously, and lead to a catastrophic medical error.
Because you're giving the exact wrong antidote to a brain that is already in crisis.
Yes. The clinical disconnect became such a persistent issue that the FDA actually had to issue a specific scientific memorandum on this exact confusion recently in September 2024.
Wow, as recently as 2024.
Yes. They formally warned clinicians not to reflexively treat Amanita ingestions as classic muscarinic poisonings with atropine because true muscarinic symptoms from this specific mushroom are usually minor or non-existent due to how little muscarine is actually inside it.
That is a staggering disconnect between the historical name, the modern science, and the medical reality in the ER.
It truly is.
But this brings up another fascinating angle. Despite these incredible dangers, the excitotoxicity, the clinical confusions, the wildly unpredictable potencies we just discussed, humans have historically used this mushroom.
They absolutely have.
We didn't just invent it to sell in Mylar bags at gas stations. There is a deep ancient history here. But our ancestors didn't just casually eat it like a modern gummy. They developed intense, incredibly specific biological rituals to manage this toxicity.
They absolutely did. If we look at the real history of use, particularly among indigenous groups like the Kordiak, Chukchi, and Evenki peoples in northeastern Siberia, we see a culture that recognized both the profound power and the profound danger of this organism.
Right.
The environment of Siberia is harsh, and this mushroom was one of the only intoxicants available. It was used ceremonially by shamans for healing rituals, divination, and spirit communication. It was decidedly not a casual recreational substance.
It wasn't just for a fun Friday night.
No. Oh. And through generations of observation, they developed an extraordinary biological workaround to survive the toxicity of ibotenic acid.
Yes, the urine recycling. We have talked about this because this completely blew my mind when I read the OTW analysis. Explain the biology of why this practice actually works.
It is a remarkable piece of ethnopharmacological ingenuity. When a human ingests the raw or dried Amanita mushroom, the body attempts to process the intense chemical load.
Right, which we know is bad.
Very bad. We've established that ibotenic acid is highly toxic. It causes severe physical distress, gastrointestinal rot, nausea, and twitching. But muscimol, the psychoactive sedative, has a very unique metabolic profile. It is remarkably stable in the human body. So stable, in fact, that it resists being broken down entirely, and a large percentage of it is excreted through the kidneys and into the urine largely intact.
So the human body essentially acts as a biological filter.
Exactly. The human digestive system and kidneys take the brunt of the damage, filtering out the harsher, more toxic components, but they pass the active intoxicant muscimol straight through to the urine.
That is wild.
Therefore, a shaman could consume the raw or dried mushroom, endure the severe physical toll and the toxic burden on their own organs, and then their urine could be collected and consumed by others in the ritual.
Drink the urine.
Drink the urine. Those secondary consumers would receive the psychoactive, onerogenic effects of the muscimol, but without the severe nausea, cramping, and toxicity of the original ibotenic acid.
Using the human body as a biological water treatment plant to filter out a neurotoxin so you can safely drink the active, it's incredibly resourceful and undeniably intense.
It is.
But to me, it really highlights the fact that this is not a casual recreational drug. You don't have to drink your friend's urine to safely process a classic psilocybin mushroom.
You certainly do not. Psilocybin has an incredibly clean safety profile in the body. And this biological filtering practice wasn't just limited to humans, by the way.
Right. The reindeer.
This is where the famous folklore connection to reindeer comes in. Reindeer in these Siberian regions actively seek out Amanita muscaria mushrooms under the snow. They love them.
They seek them out.
Yes. And indigenous humans observed this behavior. They saw the reindeer becoming intoxicated.
So they let the reindeer take the toxic hit.
Precisely. They would either slaughter an intoxicated reindeer to consume its meat, which was temporarily imbued with the active compounds, or, more commonly, they would collect the reindeer's urine in the snow.
Wow.
The reindeer's massive liver and kidneys essentially did the toxic filtering for the humans. The mushroom was actually so highly prized that it was used as a currency, traded for reindeer pelts or even live reindeer.
Which is where the entire mythology of the flying reindeer comes from. The herders are watching their massive reindeer get high on these red and white mushrooms and prance erratically around the tundra. And then the herders are drinking the reindeer urine and entering a hallucinatory waking dream state themselves. It's wild.
It is a phenomenal piece of human history.
Our sources also briefly touch on this incredibly famous hypothesis by an ethnomycologist named R. Gordon Wasson. I've seen this mentioned in documentaries. He proposed that this Amanita mushroom is actually the legendary Soma from the ancient Vedic texts of India.
Yes, Wasson's Soma hypothesis is a highly influential piece of psychedelic lore. In his 1968 book, he argued that the divine, intoxicating, and energizing drink praised in the ancient Rig Veda was actually an Amanita muscaria preparation, possibly also involving urine recycling, brought down by Aryan nomads.
It's a deeply romantic idea.
It's a deeply romantic and fascinating idea that captured the public imagination. But the OOTW sources are careful to note that it remains highly contested and largely speculative among modern historians and anthropologists.
Oh, really? Why is that?
Many point out that the effects of Amanita don't match the descriptions of Soma, which was said to be highly energizing and clear-headed. It remains an intriguing hypothesis, not established fact.
That makes sense. But the established, undeniable medical fact is what happens to a human body if you don't have a reindeer filter it for you and you just eat the mushroom directly today.
Yes, that we know for sure.
Let's look at the brutal timeline of the human experience. If someone eats these raw caps or a poorly processed gummy, walk us through what actually happens physiologically.
The timeline of the intoxication is characteristically slow and highly unreliable, which is another major safety hazard for modern consumers.
Why is it a hazard?
If someone eats the caps or a gummy, they might expect it to hit like alcohol or cannabis. It doesn't. The onset of effects might take anywhere from 30 to 90 minutes. It creeps up.
So they might take more, thinking it's not working.
Exactly. It peaks around 1 to 3 hours, and the primary acute effects can drag on for 48 hours, with severe residual effects lingering up to 24 hours.
And what are those effects? Because we know it's not just feeling a little sleepy.
Far from it. The initial body load is usually quite violent. It involves severe nausea, vomiting, dizziness, and intense sweating. As the central nervous system inhibition from the muscle mole takes hold, you see ataxia.
Ataxia, which means?
The loss of full control of bodily movements. Stumbling, inability to walk in a straight line, slurred speech. This is often accompanied by muscle fasciculations.
What are those?
These are uncontrollable, visible muscle twitches rapidly firing right beneath the skin.
That sounds awful. And that's just the physical side. Mentally, it can get incredibly dark and terrifying for some people.
Yes. Case reports in the medical toxicology literature describe intense dysphoria, delirium, and hallucinations. But these aren't the lucid, geometric, fractal patterns of psilocybin.
What are they like?
These are confused, delirious, nightmare-like states. In some documented cases, this delirium can spiral into a severe paranoid psychosis that lasts up to 5 days after ingestion, requiring psychiatric intervention.
5 days of psychosis.
Yes. In severe high-dose poisonings, the massive GABAergic inhibition shuts the brain down so thoroughly that it can lead to seizures, loss of protective airway reflexes, and deep coma.
The OOTW sources highlight a specific, tragic, fatal case that we absolutely have to mention to drive the severity home.
Yes, it was documented in the journal Wilderness and Environmental Medicine in 2022. A 44-year-old man ingested roughly 4 to 5 dried Amanita muscaria caps.
4 or 5?
He didn't eat a basketful, just 4 or 5 caps. About 10 hours later, he suffered complete cardiopulmonary arrest. Despite full medical resuscitation efforts in the hospital, he fell into an anoxic coma and died 9 days later.
That is incredibly sad.
It is. Now, fatalities from Amanita muscaria are rare. We must be scientifically clear about that, but they are absolutely real and documented.
4 or 5 dried caps. Just a handful. And it killed him. Which brings us to the absolute crescendo of this entire deep dive, the regulatory landscape.
The legal inversion.
Right, because if the historical use required filtering neurotoxins through reindeer kidneys, and the physiological risks involve comas, five-day psychosis, excitotoxic brain lesions, and actual documented fatalities from just a few caps, how on earth is this substance currently legal in the United States while psilocybin is banned as a felony?
That is the regulatory paradox that defines this entire multi-billion-dollar industry. We have to look at the legal landscape as it currently stands in 2026. Under United States federal law, the mushroom Amanita muscaria, the sedative muscimol, and even the brain-lesioning neurotoxin ibotenic acid are entirely unscheduled.
Unscheduled.
They do not appear anywhere on the Controlled Substances Act. Federally, they can be freely possessed, cultivated, extracted, and sold.
Sold as brightly colored candy in corner stores.
Yes, except in one single state. Louisiana passed a law in 2025, taking effect in August 2025, that explicitly prohibits consumer products containing muscimol or ibotenic acid.
Okay, good for Louisiana.
They recognize the hazard. But they are the lone exception at the state level right now. Meanwhile, psilocybin, which our sources rigorously point out, has literally no established lethal dose in humans, and which was ranked by the landmark Nut et al. Multi-criteria analysis in the UK, as among the least physically harmful of all common drugs remains, is Schedule A controlled substance federally.
Schedule 1, the exact same legal category as heroin, meaning the federal government claims it has no currently accepted medical use and a high potential for abuse. How did we end up in a reality where a chemical that neuroscientists use to intentionally destroy brains is sold in a colorful wrapper at the gas station, but a chemical with New England Journal of Medicine backing is locked behind Schedule 1?
It is entirely a product of historical accident, not a scientifically audited safety judgment.
A historical accident?
Yes. Psilocybin was caught up in the cultural and political sweep of the Controlled Substances Act in 1970 under the Nixon administration. It was banned not because of its neurotoxicity, because it has incredibly low organ toxicity, but because of its heavy association with the counterculture, anti-war protests, and the youth movement.
Right, it was political.
Amanita muscaria, on the other hand, was never heavily used by the 1960s counterculture in the U.S. It tastes terrible, it makes you violently ill, and it wasn't part of the zeitgeist. It simply wasn't on the government's radar.
So it just flew under the radar.
So it was never scheduled. It slipped through a historical crack.
A historical crack that a modern gummy industry has now driven a massive, unregulated truck through.
Exactly. And the FDA is frantically trying to play catch up. Because Amanita isn't scheduled by the DEA as a drug, the FDA has to approach it from a food safety perspective.
Right.
They finally took action on December 18th, 2024. The FDA formally issued a constituent update. They explicitly alerted the industry and consumers that Amanita muscaria and its constituents are not GRAS.
GRAS, which stands for
Generally Recognized as Safe. They declared them unapproved food additives that may be harmful and strongly advised the public to avoid eating any foods containing them.
But the industry's response to that FDA warning was incredibly cynical, wasn't it? They didn't just pull the products off the shelves.
Highly cynical. Instead of pulling the products, many brands simply changed the legal phrasing on the back of the gummy packaging. They continue to sell a strawberry-flavored gummy, packaged exactly like candy, but they print a tiny, microscopic legal disclaimer on the back reading, "Not for human consumption."
Not for human consumption. It's a strawberry gummy.
They are exploiting the regulatory gap to maintain profit, knowing full well the consumer intends to eat it.
It is unbelievable. And we have to contrast this legal landscape with the actual clinical evidence, because the disparity is just as wide. Let's look at the medical research for both compounds as of 2026.
The clinical evidence gap is enormous. Let's look at psilocybin first. Despite the heavy restrictions of being scheduled federally, the scientific momentum is undeniable.
It's massive right now.
Psilocybin holds an FDA breakthrough therapy designation. The prestigious New England Journal of Medicine published a robust Phase 2b randomized controlled trial in 2022 showing a highly significant reduction in treatment-resistant depression using a single dose of CYP360 psilocybin.
That's huge!
And as of early 2026, two Phase 3 trials have reported hitting their primary endpoints for severe depression. We also have massive state-level movement. Oregon, Colorado, and New Mexico have entirely decriminalized or established regulated medical frameworks for psilocybin use.
Okay, so that's psilocybin. Decades of research, massive randomized trials, New England Journal of Medicine, Phase 3 data for depression, state-level medical frameworks. Now, What is the clinical evidence for our legal over-the-counter Amanita muscaria?
Absolutely zero.
Wait, zero?
There are zero completed controlled human clinical trials of Mesomyl or A. muscaria for anxiety, for sleep, for depression, or for any psychiatric indication whatsoever.
None at all. But all these gummy brands are pushing this microdosing Mesomyl narrative on social media, claiming it's a natural alternative to benzos for sleep and anxiety.
The claims are purely anecdotal and highly irresponsible. The legal benzo alternative framing rests on a basic mechanistic plausibility, meaning, yes, it affects the GABA system, so in theory, it causes sedation. But there is no trial-grade evidence proving it is safe, effective, or appropriate for chronic use in humans.
It's just marketing.
It is aggressive marketing dressed up as medicine. And the real-world consequence of this marketing is that poison control centers and emergency rooms across the country are seeing a sharp, sustained uptick in contacts related to these specific mushroom edibles.
People are getting hurt.
People are treating a wildly unpredictable, completely unstudied substance that contains an excitotoxic component as a daily wellness supplement.
Okay, let's pull all of this together for you listening at home. We've gone incredibly deep today into the molecules, the history, and the law. But the core takeaway from both of these OITW journal sources is beautifully simple, yet profoundly important. It all comes back to those two receptors.
GABA-A versus 5-HT2A. Inhibition versus entropy. Amanita muscaria, driven by Mesomyl, is a heavy GABAergic downer. It turns the brain's electrical volume off. It induces a heavily sedated, dissociative, and potentially delirious waking dream state. And the fresh mushroom comes burdened with ibotenic acid, a literal excitotoxic neurotoxin that selectively lesions brain cells.
And psilocybin.
Psilocybin, driven by psilocin, is a classic serotonergic psychedelic. It excites the cortex, massively increases neural entropy, loosens the grip of the default mode network, and induces a lucid, expansive visionary state with an exceptionally high physiological safety margin.
They are opposite doors leading to opposite brains. Calling them both magic mushrooms is not just technically wrong, it is a dangerous mislabeling that puts people's health directly at risk.
And if we connect all of this back to where we started.
Right, walking into that smoke shop, staring at that brightly colored Mylar bag with the psychedelic font and the winking cartoon mushroom, the packaging promises you magic. The packaging promises you an ancient, expansive, natural journey. But inside is a substance that neuroscience laboratories use to permanently silence and lesion the brain.
Which leaves us with a critical, lingering question. Something for you to ponder long after this deep dive ends.
Absolutely.
We've just seen how a multi-billion-dollar market can leverage a fairy tale aesthetic and a bureaucratic legal loophole to convince millions of people to blindly consume an unstudied, unpredictable neurotoxin, all under the comforting guise of natural wellness.
It's wild. So the question you have to ask yourself is this. If modern society can be so easily duped by a cartoon mushroom into eating a laboratory lesioning agent, what other natural and legal wellness trends in your daily life are you trusting completely? Are you trusting them because you actually understand the fundamental biology behind them, or are you just believing the font on the packaging?